I'm Dan Telvach, environmental reporter for Investigative Post, a nonprofit investigative reporting center dedicated exclusively to watchdog journalism in Buffalo and Western New York. In this week's episode, I interviewed Bill McKibben, an environmentalist and author who wrote the first book on climate change. He founded 350.org, the first grassroots climate change movement. I was able to interview Bill on the phone as he was passing through airports for his visit to Buffalo on Friday for the Buffalo Humanities Festival. We talked about a wide range of topics, including environmentalism under the Trump era, the Great Lakes, and how the movement has evolved over the past decade.
How are you holding up, knowing, you know, watching what's happening in the world today? You know, it's a good time to be an environmentalist, but it's in a way, it's also a bad time.
No, it's a terrible moment. I mean, we're watching things that people have fought hard for the last 40 years be rolled back in the course of, you know, a few months without hearings, without just one executive order after another, canceling the laws that have cleaned up our air and our water. And that's bad enough. You know, the biggest problem, of course, is what's happened to the beginnings of the momentum against climate change. Just as the world and the nation were starting to build a little bit of momentum to finally begin addressing the biggest problem we've ever faced, you know, now we've hit either a very big pothole or a crevasse in the road. And, you know, it couldn't have come at a worse time. Climate change is the first time-limited problem that we've ever really had to deal with. And so if we don't solve it soon, we don't solve it. And so just taking 4 years off and pretending that it doesn't exist turns out to be a very bad idea.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, you know, how much time do we have? I mean, you call this the greatest crisis president has ever faced. How much time do we have?
Well, I mean, the real answer to that is, you know, to have really handled this crisis, we needed to start 25 or 30 years ago. And you know, I wrote the first book on all of this, and it's almost 30 years old now. And so I have to refrain from saying, oh, if only you'd listen to me then. There's not much point in that. But we've already done enormous damage. You know, we've lost half the summer sea ice in the Arctic. September this month, 2017, turns out to have had more hurricane activity than any month since we started in the Atlantic, than any month since we started keeping records in 1851. You know, the last 3 years have set new all-time temperature records. We think we've lost some massive percentage of the world's coral reefs over the last 2 or 3 years. So it's not as if, you know, we're going to stop global warming and keep it from being a problem. The question now is whether we can stop it short of just destroying the civilization our forebears built. And that's an open question. You know, the rates of sea level rise and temperature increase that we're starting to see are taking us into extremely, extremely dangerous places. And they have a lot of momentum behind them. You know, it's going to be very hard to turn it around. And that means that that 4 years adrift is a very big problem. I mean, it's not even adrift. It's not as if we've just stopped. I mean, the president's trying to revive the 18th century technology of coal mining, you know. I mean, look at the sad part of it is that it comes at a moment when he could be doing, or any leader could be doing, just the opposite. You know, the price of the solar panel or wind power in the last 10 years has just plummeted to the point where we have extraordinary possibilities. Look at the gigafactory you guys have out there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The price of a battery to store electricity has dropped so fast over the last 3 or 4 years that it should be rewriting every decision we make about energy. But instead, nationally, we're trying to just go backwards somehow.
Bill, part of this, you know, we're talking when we're talking about climate change, and we're talking about changing people's habits, not just in the United States, but in the world. And we're talking
yes.
about driving cars, turning on the thermostat, what we throw away, what we eat.
Yes.
I mean, do you think it's part of the reason why this has been such a hard fight? Because it's we're trying to change habits. It's you know we're in a habit. It's like it's hard to change these things, isn't it?
It is part of the problem, but I think that was the kind of initial environmentalist diagnosis of about 10 or 15 years ago. And I think now what people have figured out is that that's less the problem. Most people could care less, you know, if they flick the switch, whether the power that turns on their efficient light came from a coal mine or a solar panel. They might prefer it come from a solar panel, in fact, but they don't really think about it very much one way or t'other. The people who do think about it are the people who own coal mines and oil wells and gas pipelines and things. And that's, I think, now why we've managed to make so little progress. We know from terrific investigative reporting inside Climate News, the LA Times, the Columbia Journalism School, beginning about 2 years ago, uncovered what may be the most telling kind of history of our time, the completely obvious documentation that Exxon and the other big oil companies knew everything there was to know about climate change 30 and 40 years ago, and knew it and understood it to be true, started building their own drilling rigs to accommodate the sea level rise they knew was coming. But instead of telling anybody else, they instead bankrolled the kind of forces of deceit and denial and disinformation and kept this completely phony debate alive for a critical quarter century. And eventually managed to reach the point where they had convinced the president of the United States that climate change was a hoax invented by the Chinese. I mean, this is a corporate crime of remarkable, of probably the greatest corporate crime ever. It's very good to see, you know, brave people like Eric Schneiderman trying to get to the bottom of it. He's really leading the country in trying to prosecute, investigate it. But none of that can undo the damage that has accumulated over the last quarter century of inaction. It's not that we would have, if Exxon and its ilk had done the right thing 30 years ago, it's not that we would have solved the problem now. It's a big enough problem that we'd still be working on it. But we'd be well on the way, and we wouldn't have wasted what may turn out to be, in kind of geologic time, a critical generation.
You've been at this a long time, more than three decades. How has the climate change movement evolved over the past decade? Has it changed a lot?
Yes, then that's an interesting question. For a long time, there was no climate change movement. And and it's because people like me just misunderstood how things worked. I think we all thought that the scientists had issued such a clear and compelling warning. We'd been told what was going to happen, why and how, and so on. We assumed that people who ran things would do something about it. And so people like me or, Al Gore, whoever it was, our job was to write books, make movies, inform people. And I wasted a lot of time doing that, I now think. It was very important to have the books and the arguments and the facts, but in the end, it turned out we weren't engaged in an argument. We'd won the argument. The science was clear. We were engaged in a fight, And the fight, as all fights are, was about money and power. And so we were going to have to build some power. And that's why, I sort of took a detour in my life 10 years ago now and started this group 350.org that became really the first global grassroots climate group. I mean, it's just volunteer work for me. It's what I've been spent most of my time doing the last 10 years. But it's, helped build what's now become a pretty substantial activist grassroots in the streets climate movement. And it's had its successes. We've managed to, we started fights about things like the Keystone Pipeline. And as a result, those, now people challenge, I think, pretty much every piece of fossil fuel infrastructure. And quite often we win. It's had real successes. But, the same decade has watched the science get darker and darker. And so, we need to step up the game.
If we don't begin stepping up the game, and it doesn't look like politically we will be anytime soon, let's localize this a little bit. What can the Great Lakes region anticipate in the next 10, 20? Go ahead.
That's a very good question. And let me answer it two ways. One is we're definitely not going to step up the game at the national level.
Mm-hmm.
That means that we're going to have to do a lot of work at the state and local levels. We're pushing hard for every state and city and things to go for 100% renewable energy, and increasing number are making that commitment, and not just the obvious places, now Atlanta, Salt Lake City, and San Diego and things have made these commitments. It's good to see the amount of work that's going on in New York State, for instance. I think that the people who are doing the sort of utility reform, whatever they call it, the REV process, New York are serious, and it's a hard job, but I'm glad that they're at it. New York and California are going to have to step up, or Washington won't now. As to what we can expect in places like the Great Lakes, the general rule of thumb is whatever you're getting, you're going to get more of it.
Oh, you're talking about lake effect snow.
Well,
that's going to grab people's attention.
it's certainly precipitation, but less and less of it eventually will be coming as snow. I mean, the one thing that's very clear is that temperatures are steadily going up. Mm-hmm. There'll be years, however. One of the interesting things that seems to be happening that people didn't, I think, really know was going to happen, because it's an experiment we haven't run before. As we melt the Arctic, one of the things that's happening is the jet stream is getting caught in a much more high amplitude formation than we've seen in the past. Very dramatic ups and downs in the jet stream, and they tend to get stuck and stay in place for longer than they used to. And so when it starts raining, rain for a long time, and when you have a drought, you can get a drought for a long time. In our part of the world, in the Northeast, storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain, so in a 24-hour period, so they're really bad, damaging rainstorms, the ones that do nobody any good, those have increased about 75% over the last, I think, about the last 50 years. One of the things that means is that if there's no other local official who understands global warming, you can count on the local superintendent of the DPW to understand, because he has spent the last 20 years ripping out 8-inch culverts and putting in 12-inch culverts, because the old book, and there literally is a book that tells you how big your culverts are supposed to be, the old book does not work, It's not right anymore.
And we did have a pretty rainy year this year, that's for sure. So you're saying that we can anticipate more of that?
Absolutely. More extremes of all kinds, except cold. We shouldn't get extreme. We should get less extreme cold and more extreme heat going forward. Truthfully, the Great Lakes are, everybody's going to pay serious price for this, but we're not going to pay, at least initially, as serious a price as people who live in low-lying Pacific Islands or in, you know, Asian ocean deltas or places like Puerto Rico. Or there's an almost perfect inverse relationship between how much of the problem you caused and how much of the pain you feel right away. The poorest people around the world are at the greatest risk, having done almost nothing to cause the problem.
Okay, so there was a story 2 days ago in the New York Times. The headline is attention-grabbing in itself. The headline is, "Corporations Have Rights, Why Not Rivers?" And in a nutshell, there's an attorney in Denver who filed a lawsuit, federal lawsuit, first of its kind, with an environmental group, asking a judge to recognize the Colorado River as a person. What do you think of that? I mean, legal pundits are saying this is a long shot, but it does raise an interesting point. And
yes, absolutely. And
what do you think?
It's not the first time that it's been raised. You know, the Supreme Court came, I think, within a single vote of giving trees standing, as it were, in the 1960s. And if you think about it, if you want to believe that, you know, Exxon is a person, which legally we've decided that it is, it makes at least as much sense to believe that the Colorado River or Lake Erie or something deserves representation too. We're far more dependent, all of us in the end, on the lake and the river being respected than we are on Exxon being respected, you know.
So you believe it obviously has merit?
I haven't seen the case, so I don't know this particular thing, but I think that the general principle that we should be taking extraordinarily seriously, including in the courts, the necessity to keep our ecosystems working is obvious.
Yeah, it would have huge impacts on the environment if such a case did, you know,
There's some really interesting cases like this, and there's a case that's been working its way through the federal courts in which a group of young people, now not as young as they were when they filed it, have sued the federal government for failing to safeguard what they've called the public trust of the atmosphere, saying the decisions you're making are and failing to make now to protect this thing we share in common, the atmosphere, are clearly going to cause huge damages for us as we grow older. And so far that case, somewhat surprisingly, has made it through the federal courts and will be argued before a federal judge in February.
Very interesting. Well, Bill, it was a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
Mine.
Yeah,
it was good to talk. And I'll just say, one of the reasons I'm excited to be coming to Buffalo is that Gigafactory thing. You guys are on the cutting edge of something really important. You know?
Sure. Sure.
It's the notion that someday we might stop talking about the Rust Belt and start thinking about it as the, solar belt or something is an encouraging one.
I'd like to thank Bill McKibben for his time in doing this podcast with me. I'd also like to remind listeners that our annual gala is October 19th at the Hyatt Regency. Sarah Cohen, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and editor at the New York Times, will be our keynote speaker. Tickets can be purchased online at investigativepost.org. Thanks again for listening.